And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of November 18th, 2022. The global carbon dioxide level is 417.94 parts per million. That's almost 418 parts per million, where the place we need to be is only 350. Parts per million. So we're way over target right now. And it turns out there are 2,604 days left until the year 2030. There's 2,604 days to get our carbon emissions down, carbon pollution down by 50%. We've got a lot of work to do. Anyway, today we're pleased to be joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well, and I'm looking forward to our discussion today about the midterm election outcomes and what they mean for the climate.
So I don't know if you noticed, Mariah, but about this time last week, we had an election. Did you see that anywhere in the news?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I think we were both too nervous to even think about recording a show on that day.
Yes. So every news show has been flooded with news about the election. So it's not as if this is we're going to break anything new and announce that Katie Hobbs won Arizona, hooray, hooray, or all that kind of happy stuff. But it's an interesting question to stop for a minute and ponder how the results of this election interact with the climate issue, right? It's always what we come back to. I mean, how does this all come together? So let me just give you my take on it, right? So the election was, we were told beforehand, and everyone's heard this now, we were all told beforehand that the election was going to be about gas prices and inflation and crime, and that there were all these polls showing a red wave, that the GOP was going to take the House and the Senate, and it was going to be a hellscape, to quote Elon Musk, right? Things were going to be bad because the GOP had momentum. It turned out not to be that way, right? The Democratic Party was basically able to stop the red wave, keep everything in rather remarkable results, right? So now a week on, we know that the Senate, the U.S. Senate will remain in the hands of the Democrats, right? The U.S. House is still to be determined, which is by itself is shocking. It's a week later, we haven't figured all that stuff out, right? But it's sufficiently close that there's still a question, right? There have been a lot of blue state, a lot of governors, of Democratic governors elected. It turns out that the secretaries of state, those people who run the elections in the various states, all of the people who denied the 2020 election, all of them got defeated, which is, again, remarkable. And everything's good. I mean, everything's not good, but things are a whole lot better than they could have been. Right, Mariah? Yeah. Did you see any of this stuff?
Yeah, and I think that it's important to note that, you know, oftentimes in midterm elections, there's a big swing from one party to the next. That's just sort of, I think, not just oftentimes. I think that's the norm, is that if you have a Democrat, you know, controlled House and Senate and president, then it will switch. The midterms will always swing it over to Republican control. That's what happened in all of the prior midterm elections, I think dating back at least to, like, you know.
Oh my God.
Like 20 years ago. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the midterm election of the first term of a president is always a bloodbath for the president's party. Right.
Yeah. So the fact that it's not, I think, you know, it does. You say, okay, well, what was it? Why was it that it wasn't a red tsunami and it was more of a, you know, I think people say like a trickle, right? and why was it just this like sort of pink spritz, pink spritz, exactly. And I mean, I think that's what we're here to talk about today, right? How does climate change factor into that? Would really be our focus, but
absolutely. And basically, that's the question. Is what it seems, and again, all I know is what I read in the paper and see on the TV. But it seems as if, in fact, people across the country were concerned about both abortion and the democracy, that those were the two driving issues, and that the quote-unquote youth vote, right, which is are the, I don't even want to give a generational name, but I mean, younger people were actively involved and they primarily came out because of abortion and democracy as motivating factors. That seems to be what the exit polls, for what it's worth. Remember, there was a day not too long ago, maybe 10 years ago, where you could interview people coming out of the polls and ask them how they voted and get a pretty good idea. And now with half the people mailing their ballots in, you have no idea what's actually going to happen.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. It was, you know, abortion and democracy that were really on the ballot. Those were sort of the big issues. But if you think back to prior elections where, you know, climate change was kind of always there, right? There was always sort of a, well, you know, they're going to kill the economy with their green initiatives and different things like that, that have been on the ballot in a different way in the past. And it was very quiet on the climate change front in this election. There was nobody was, you know, sort of punching holes in the Inflation Reduction Act or saying how terrible it is or saying this Democrat is supporting that, so you shouldn't support this Democrat, right? There was none of that going on, which is interesting in and of itself.
I think that is a fascinating aspect of all this, is that the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, right? That was a punching bag for the conservative side of the aisle for election after election. And you could easily imagine the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the biggest climate act since, biggest like federal legislation since the New Deal in the 1960s, right? Nobody, Republicans did not attack it. It was dead silent. And I think so tell me, what do you think the implications are there? What does it mean? Right, the Sherlock Holmesian dog that did not bark in the nighttime or whatever. Right, I mean, what does it mean that there's the people who the Republican side, the conservative people who hate climate change stuff, would not even dare to say the name of IRA?
I think that Bill McKibben wrote a nice piece. I guess it was is it a Substack that he
wrote?
It's
a Substack he has, but he published it in the New York Times. Or somehow it's all,
Yes, you can get it without paying. And it's an interesting article. Someday the climate fight will be dull, he says, and that's how we'll know we're winning. That's the title of Bill McKibben's article. And he basically says that the Republicans that might have pushed back against the IRA know that it creates jobs. Right. And people are really big on the jobs, and that in general, you know, this move towards climate change is a job creating towards climate action is a job creating move. And so they'll still push back. I think that McKibben talked about Walker sort of saying that, you know, I mean, some ridiculous stuff about sending good air to China and, you know, defending gas guzzlers. So he was, you know, he was, and that was part of his campaign. But he also said, you know, if we, I think this is a quote from Walker, if we was ready for the green agenda, I'd raise my hand right now, but we're not ready right now, which is an interesting nod to say, okay, I'm not denying that we need a green agenda. We just don't need it right now. And that's, I think, kind of a common rhetoric happening in a lot of places, in a lot of Republican circles, like, well, we're just not ready for it. So, you know, it's no longer denial necessarily, but it's just, you know, pushing it off. But all that is to say, they realize that it's not popular to put down climate action or to say we don't need climate action. That's not going to win them elections. So they just didn't say anything about it at all.
Yes. And I agree. I think that the flip side is that in addition to being a jobs engine, and money that people want, I think there's a hugely more sympathy for the need for climate action, particularly among the youth vote, right? Without being more specific than that. I mean, that it matters to a lot of people. What is it? In Ocasio-Cortez says, you know, some people have to live in the future that you're burning up, right?
Yeah.
So these, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing. But yeah.
And McKibben's title is, I think of this Substack as even interesting, right? He says, someday the climate fight will be dull, and that's how we'll know we're winning. And he talks about, you know, in contrast to Walker, right? So Walker and Herschel Walker and Raphael Warnock are in the Georgia runoff. So they have, you know, they're still competing for that Senate seat. And McKibben contrasted their sort of stances on climate change. I gave you Walker's, but he said about Raphael Warnock that he's basically saying, you know, he talked about some of the stuff Georgia is doing for the green, you know, the clean energy economy, but he didn't talk about it in terms of, like, I think they just got a big $178 million battery facility online. And so Raphael Warnock talked about that battery facility, but not in terms of like, this is going to be great for the, you know, green energy and for the climate, you know, addressing climate crisis. He didn't talk about it that way. He talked about it in that it's going to make good jobs and it's going to have, you know, critical investments and bring business to Georgia. And McKibben said, that's not how I would have talked about it, right? McKibben, as a climate activist, would have gone on and on about the green benefits. And he said, but if I was in Georgia talking about it that way, I would have lost the Georgia election because that's not what Georgia wants to hear. And the way that Raphael Warnock spoke about it was, you know, as if the climate change part of it was dull. We've already moved beyond that as a need. It's an obviously we have to address climate change. What's exciting about it is that we're creating jobs and bringing business to Georgia. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting point. And, yeah. And I agree, that would be wonderful if climate change becomes dull. We might be out of a job, but you know, nobody will listen to our podcast anymore.
Well, I think there's yes, it would be great to work yourself out of a job, but I think we got a ways to go, especially tracking the full and proper implementation. At some point, we have to start, you and I need to have some sort of a discussion about how the money from the IRA is going to trickle down to people's pocketbooks, right? Because that's a big issue. It's really complicated. If you're going to spend, you know, $400 billion, it's complicated to explain how it's going to get in. But that's an interesting So anyway, so after we've got this election where, number one, the democracy was preserved for another 2 years, right? 2024, we'll have to have the battle all over again, right? But right now, democracy looks like it won. Second sort of big top level out, and of course, if you don't have a democracy, you don't have climate action, right? Putin's not doing anything about climate action over in Russia, right? And there you go. That's your take-home lesson, right? So we need to have a democracy to have input from people to take climate action. That's still going along. The other thing is that no one complained about the IRA, right? So now that's like a given. That's just built in, and that's a good foundation for us to go forward on. Those are great take-homes from the 2022 midterm elections. We saw an article from the Sierra Club, Mariah, that went on and talked about some more specific points I think it's worth referring to. So what we were saying before, that there is the control of the House of Representatives is still to be determined, okay? So it turns out you need 218 people to get together to elect a speaker. So you need at least 200. That's a majority, right? You have to have 218 in order to pass anything. Neither party is there yet. The Republicans have a clear lead. They are projected to get something like 220. Democrats are going to get something like 215. Fine. Likely it's going to end up that the GOP runs the House. If you're watching the news today, they are all having a circular firing squad about who's going to be the craziest and elect, you know, how cuckoo and Speaker of the House are they going to elect? But that's neither here nor there for the moment, right? It's probably going to be Republican controlled. If that is the case, basically, further legislation coming out of the federal government, like the IRA, is on hold for 2 years, right? Nobody expects there to be any substantive legislation coming through a Republican-controlled House of Representatives, right? That makes sense.
Right. There's other things that threat too, right? Where the, you know, if the Republicans control the House, they would possibly or likely abolish the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, and that there would also be no more House Oversight Committee hearings probing the disinformation campaigns by a lot of the big oil fossil fuel folks.
Right.
So those are some things that we will lose in a GOP-controlled House.
I mean, if you want to maintain a fantasy, I submit this to think about. Suppose the Republicans end up with exactly 218 votes, right? Enough to control the House. Democrats have the complement with 217 votes. There are a lot of Republicans that just got elected from New York, from somewhat purplish districts, right? And you could go and say, hey, Nancy Pelosi could go to them and say, look, in 2 years, you're going to have to go back and face those people. Do you want to be associated with the extremism that is likely to come from a Jew? And if it's that close, anything could happen, right? You could have, and you have 435 people in the House. There's going to be special elections, right? Someone's going to resign. Someone's going to get sick. I mean, so it's so close that, you know, you can at least dream that maybe something, it might not be the full 2 years of stalemate. So
that would
there
be
you go.
Something to hope for.
Excuse me. Something to hope for. I, you know, keep hope alive.
Yeah.
We've touched on the second point that the article makes is that basically the IRA is beloved by everyone now. Republicans don't want to attack it. They didn't say anything about it. And so it is now, I wouldn't quite say it's up there with Social Security, but it is a jobs engine. People are going to find it more and more. It's harder and harder to attack it. And so that is a victory for climate hawks, right?
Yeah.
A third interesting point they make, and this one has particular relevance to Massachusetts, is that there were a whole bunch of Democratic governors elected. So there was, I cannot remember the gentleman's name, in Maryland. Right? So Maryland now has a Democratic governor. They could join Reggie.
Is it Westmore?
Westmore. Okay, yes, yes.
Yeah.
they could join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or at least be more enthusiastic. There is a up in Michigan, Whitmer, I forget the person's name, Gretchen Whitmer, right? She won big. She is also the person that shut down the pipeline that runs under Lake Michigan, right? So now she's got a full trifecta of the whole the whole thing. But perhaps most interestingly for us is that here in Massachusetts, Maura Healey won. Right, so now we have a Democratic woman, a Democratic governor for the first time in Massachusetts history, a woman governor, which is fantastic, an openly gay governor, which is great. And in fact, all of the constitutional offices in the state are held by women, which is fantastic, right?
Yeah, that's all very exciting. I don't, I mean, you know, certainly I think Maura Healey will do a lot for climate initiatives.
I think Massachusetts is just this is like a side note. Massachusetts has the oldest functioning democracy in the world, the oldest functioning constitution. And we in the state have four constitutionally elected offices, right? In the United States federal government, the only elected office for the whole country is the president and the vice president, right? We don't elect the attorney general. We don't elect the secretary of state. We don't elect the treasury people at the national level. But here in Massachusetts, the power was divided up amongst these four people who are all supposed to be guarding their little fiefdom, right, and making sure the Constitution runs properly. As it stands now, they're all Democrats, right, as is the House and the Senate. So it is really a Democratic lock. And I think that, of course, what will happen, I suspect here in Massachusetts, is that we will have different factions of the Democratic Party come out of the woodwork, right? People marginally different arguing about things, and that will be the impediment to progress. But I heard that Maura Healey is planning to appoint a climate czar or some sort of overlord or overmistress. I don't know what the right word is, but basically someone whose task it is, excuse me, I got a frog in my throat, whose task it is to align all the state bureaucracies, which I think is really interesting because I've been making the case that here in Massachusetts, we have a roadmap. Right, we have a roadmap by 2030, 2050. We all know what we're going to do, but there's no enforcer that makes sure the Department of Housing, the Department of Transportation, and all these sort of disparate, you know, the Department of Child Welfare, right, that they're all focused on the roadmap and the things that they are doing are not fighting each other, right? And I think so. If Healey comes in with a mindset of having the whole Massachusetts bureaucracy aligned towards the roadmap climate goals, that would be a very nuanced thing, right? But you would not have, the Department of Transportation building new roads instead of putting in electric vehicle charges or something like that, right? So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And I suspect that there will be here in Massachusetts, as you may remember, there's lots of the utilities want to put hydrogen into your pipelines, right? So just to rewind, right? Maura Healey, when she was Attorney General, sent to the Department of Public Utilities a mandate that they would plan, the DPU would plan to transition the state off gas off natural gas by 2050. The DPU turned around and asked the utilities to write the plan for their own demise. Right? Please write a plan telling me how you're going to put yourself out of business. And of course, the utilities came back and said, oh, everything's going to be fine. We're going to use hydrogen instead of natural gas, and everything's going to be great in 2050, which of course is its own problem. Maura Healey objected to that, and as the Attorney General, she didn't find it a satisfactory response. But now she's governor. Right? She's the one who's flying the 747. And so I have a feeling that this plan by the utilities to put hydrogen into our natural gas pipelines may face more opposition. I can only hope, right? So there's that. Massachusetts is in a good position following the midterm elections to do great things on climate.
And Ted, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we did a podcast about hydrogen and some of the opportunities but challenges with hydrogen power several months ago. Yes, but yes, it's there somewhere if people wanted to learn a little bit more about why hydrogen.
I will try and dig it. I mean, it is a particular itch under my skin that because it's just such a crazy thing to propose, but. I guess the other point that this article, so we're sort of reviewing this Sierra Club summary of the election. They were saying, the article says that basically, again, the youth vote that we touched on before really came through, right? They defined, they were a big part of the success in holding off all the bad things that could have happened in this election. And those kids are more progressive, more thoughtful, and they're the future, right? They're going to be there. So now it's I've seen commentary on TV that, like, if I was Bernie Sanders, I'd be saying, yeah, we now need to give to that generation the things they expect, right, and help them out because that's the right way to keep everyone involved. And so it's quite interesting. And then the last point they made is that because the Senate is still in Democratic hands, that Biden's appointments to the judiciary, which now, given the state of the Supreme Court, right, is very important. that he can continue to put people on the federal bench that will be, I'm not sure what the right word is. It's not sympathetic to climate issues, but at least on the assumption that climate issues are middle of the road, legitimate things that can be dealt with by law, the kinds of people that Biden would appoint to the federal court are probably going to at least give a fair hearing to climate cases. Mm. And that's a good thing. That gets to go on for another 2 years, and Mitch McConnell can't get in to screw things up, which is a good sign, right? I mean, you can take small blessings where you can, huh?
Right.
So that's the story, Mariah. We I don't know what the analogy is. We didn't dodge a bullet. I think that people, and I think it's to the credit, it is heartening. People, despite the noise and the palaver and the Joe Scarboroughs of the world, right, telling you what to think, people, the American people, fought their own thoughts and went out and did what they knew they needed to do. And we, after this midterm elections, both as a democracy and as climate activists, have great cause to be happy. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a lot to be, a lot of small blessings to celebrate, as you said.
That's right. That's right. So what I'll do, Mariah, is we'll put up links to some of the stuff that we talked about. We'll try and dig up that old hydrogen podcast from a while ago and various things like that, so that people could listen to it if they want. We'll put those on the blog at massclimateaction.org. If you go to that website, look across the top for newsletter and more, pull it down for the menu down for blog and podcast, and we're in there. If you have any ideas about what we should be talking about on the show, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be discussing. You're probably listening to this show on your smartphone using a modern podcast distribution app. Please tell all your friends about us so they can listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support, always giving us interesting things to think about and to talk about. We appreciate it, D.R. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. Because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just, an equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. Well, Mariah, thank you for being here to celebrate.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.